This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's quote is from Lift As You Climb by Viv Groskop. She's talking about this exercise where she encourages people to say their full name and their title out loud when introducing themselves, because so few of us do. And she says, with a lovely amount of tough love, if you cannot say your name properly and confidently, and you cannot say your job title without cringing, then I really do question whether you are using your one precious life in the way that you could be using it. It's a great exercise for figuring out whether you're okay with who you are. And maybe a sense of self is what a lot of this work is really about. Are you okay with who you are? If so, be it. And say it. If you're not, then change something. This sounds easy, but it is the work of a lifetime to be at ease with yourself. Welcome to the podcast that's all about the voice, which means it's all about power. Who has it, how we get it, how we sound when we have it. I'm your host, Samara Bay, and this is Permission to Speak, where we can throw all our best ideas about how to get ourselves heard into the pot and stir. Today's guest is Sarah Jones. She has won a Tony Award and an Obie Award for her one-woman shows, starting with Bridge and Tunnel, which was originally produced by Meryl Streep and then went on to Broadway. Her TED mainstage talks have gotten millions and millions of views, and I truly hope you go and check them out after this if you haven't seen them already. She has performed for the Obamas. I mean, she's friends with Gloria Steinem and Bryan Stevenson and is a legend. I wanted to have her on for obviously all of these reasons, but also because I remember the feeling when I saw her first TED Talk, which was like 15 years ago. She does funny voices, guys, but I mean, she does so much more than that. She inhabits the bodies and the worlds of the people that she plays so that the voices emerge out of the life experiences and hopes and fears of the characters, which is how our voices work, as I always like to talk about. And I mean, the other thing is that the people who live in her and, by the way, come out all the time and it is bonkers and amazing, the people who live in her are wrestling with their identities and with the promise or the fake promise of the American dream, and something that we talk about in this interview, which is the very real urge to speak when it becomes stronger than the fear of being seen and being heard. And I loved this conversation and how much wisdom she is full of, as well as voices. And we went a little long. You'll see why. This is Sarah.
I I've looked back over some of the videos where I'm like, oh my God, did you really, you know, put yourself into a public forum looking like that? And what it teaches me is I'm too focused on how I look. Mm-hmm. Like that's the work. The work, mm-hmm. the opportunity is like, I'm messy. It's a pandemic. I'm in the hospital. I'm out of the hospital. I don't know how to talk about that. I'm going to say all of that instead of hiding it. Yeah. And what it has done is opened up a lot of space for me to feel a little bit more connected, although we can talk about Zoom. And I'm not a social scientist or a neurologist, but I'm convinced that there's a sort of a, you know, like there must be a cognitive dissonance that's happening for all of us collectively, because we can FaceTime, we can Zoom, we can WhatsApp or whatever, but you're not here. And so I'm sort of tricked into feeling like I could reach out and hug Samara right now. But I can't, you know, I'm like, eh, there's nothing there. And I had this boyfriend who didn't like to FaceTime. And I was like, what's wrong with it? And he was like, it's not real, Sarah. He was like this Vermont snowboarder, like, you know, he wanted to like hug trees and like rip them out of the ground. I don't know. But he really made this point that it is real, but it isn't. And there was something very beautiful about that. And I'm experiencing it now. It is connected, but I want to be clear with myself. I'm not getting human, you know, unmitigated eye contact and hugs,
I mean,
and air.
What you're dipping into is also something that we've had to deal with for our entire lives as technology has progressed like this. And our physical bodies are still the bodies of people from thousands of years ago.
Exactly.
And like there is something in our brain that is making that connection, that is saying, especially in times like this where we need connection, that is saying, this is good enough. This is a ghost hug, right? It's right. I will envision a hug, I will see you, and those two things together will do something that's better than nothing. But on the other hand, no, it's not the same as a real hug.
It's not the same.
Ah, Sarah, hi.
Hi, how are you, my love?
I'm okay. I mean, oh, everything you were talking about, it's so true. I think you were talking about the concept of lowering expectations. And I actually
broadening,
and reframing it as broadening. And I actually wonder also if it's the expectations themselves that we should be taking a closer look at. You know,
yes.
I mean, a lot of what we were talking about was the expectations we've set up for ourselves of what it would look like if we had everything put together.
Yes, the myth of, you know, we've all talked about it—the superwoman who has to juggle everything and. Even as we try to get into less, you know, gender normative conversations about family, and I'm not a mom, but I remember my mom, who, it's interesting, in this time of COVID, I'm thinking about doctors differently. Both my mom and dad were doctors. Guess who was responsible for maintaining, you know, all the household stuff and the kids and blah. My mom, she went and delivered babies and was still expected to keep it all together. And I think we haven't strayed very far from that. We've just sort of ignored our limitation, like our normal, healthy human limitations. And so we multitask and we buy a million systems and things to keep ourselves, you know, impossibly efficient and together. And I don't think it's healthy for anybody.
So I was so excited to have you on this podcast about voices because hello.
Hello. We're all here, by the way. We're all here.
Oh, good. Hi. I can't wait to maybe hear a little. They're all welcome. And this is my first podcast with like 10 people.
Sorry.
But you know what I was thinking is, you know, like it's such a surface level thing to say that you do voices because, you know, yes, you do. And they're brilliant. And also, you bring fully inhabited other people onto the stage with you. I mean, for anyone who's seen your shows, starting with Bridge and Tunnel, which ended up on Broadway, it's just you, but it's also truly not.
Thinking that you could do, quote unquote, do funny voices and end up on Broadway, like, you know what I mean? It was so wild to me that the thing I had always done, I mean, this, Lorraine Levine.
Hi there. I brought my glasses, even though you can't see me, which seems so silly, but if I don't have my glasses, I can't see. Anyway, Sarah started doing the voices, like she says, because her family, you know, she came from the multicultural family, the black, the white, they intermarried and all. It's very normal now. But anyway, I think that it kept her feeling playful as a child, you know, that she could do that. And she would do it with her friends.
I would. I would do that with my friends.
I know. It's so interesting. It makes me think of you said, I believe it was your first TED Talk. This is a direct Sarah Jones quote. You said, we're all born into certain circumstances with particular physical traits, unique developmental experiences, geographical and historical contexts. But then what? To what extent do we self-construct? To what extent do we self-invent? How do we self-identify? And how mutable is that self-identity? You know, obviously I came up through doing dialect coaching with actors, so it's in a literal way, you know, when we put on a new accent, what does it reveal to us about how that character has gone through their life and how they hold their body and, you know, how does it inform us? But it's not just for actors. I mean, that's really, you know, the heart of this work is what we're both talking about in different ways is how our life experiences are reflected in our voice and what that says about how we are perceived by others and how we perceive ourselves. And also the part I want to talk to you about is like this mutability issue, this idea that like certain things we don't have control over. And then what do we do with the things we do?
Yeah. Thank you for that. As I was listening to you, I was like, did I say that? But I do remember writing that. I remember writing it because it felt so true for me. It felt so kind of essential as a question. Who the hell am I? I mean, really, it was like, who am I anyway? Like you said, how much does the outside gaze of others, you know, inform who I am, decide who I am, decide whether I live or die? You know, if you're a Black or brown man or woman in an encounter with police, like how you're perceived, your voice can be the difference between your survival or not. So I never want to be one of those people who says, oh, you get to decide completely everything about your fate. Absolutely not. Yes, and we do have, right? Like we do, I mean, the performance that you help an actor find hopefully is as authentic and beautiful as whatever they can muster using the tools you're giving them. And then like all of us are kind of performing a life, right?
And what you're talking about is such an important distinction or like lack of distinction, which is on the one hand, performing, what are we putting on because it's interesting because we're becoming this person because we're acting as if, and what is a coping mechanism?
Yes. And knowing the difference, I think there's like, you know, I'm paid as an actor to go on stage or be in a film and be someone other than I am. Then it's like, wait a minute, if I'm having a low self-worth moment at a party, and I turn to the guy next to me and decide I'm just going to be a sexy Naomi Campbell version of myself or whoever, which I used to do, by the way. I would, when I was really nervous at a party, if I felt like it, I would just sort of slip into this. And you would not believe, first of all, I thought I was sexier, right? So then these blokes would line up around me. I had not changed one iota. My appearance didn't change. Nothing about me changed. But something about this voice of this alter ego made me feel safer because I was fearful myself. And I realized you can't do that, number one. It doesn't work out well for the relationship.
I mean, Elizabeth Holmes comes to mind as sort of a cautionary tale.
There's one cautionary tale. I could tell you a few. It definitely makes the one night stand. It's a lot of work to keep that up. You got to like maintain, you know. It's not easy to maintain that. But I will say that's sort of one end of the spectrum. But somewhere on that continuum, you know, if I'm not careful, I'll pretend my way through my day, through my life, even in my most intimate relationships and even with myself. And so I think it is interesting whether it's voices. I mean, there's like all my voices of like all my people, but it's not just a voice. Like I'm Bella. I'm a person, you know, and like I exist in a context, like a radical feminist context, obvi. And like, you know, when I think about Bella, she's not just a vocal fry, like a concave chested, you know, self-deprecating, but still wanting to be, you know, powerful young feminist. Because of her voice, like it's not just a voice, it's all of who she believes she is, and then how that gets questioned every moment of every day. And are we present enough to listen? Like, am I present enough to hear, wait a minute, that was an inauthentic thing I said just then. I don't really mean that. I just told that person, love you, bye. Do I love them, like at all? Or is that, you know what I mean? Like just checking in and being like, what am I putting out into the world? And how is there this kind of feedback loop between me and the world and what I think I need to be and how I think I need to sound or look or, you know, be in my life on the socials or whatever. And then what I'm telling myself isn't adequate about me, maybe because of that. I think there's a loop that can get started that's, this is who I have to be. And then, oh, look, I'm not actually really measuring up. And so I'm interested in how can we self-reinvent, you know, how can we invent ourselves or step more fully into who we actually are in a way that makes our voice more authentic, more powerful, and ultimately more loving, right? Because when you hate yourself, you go off and do things like make a giant tiger, you know, whatever. Like I couldn't watch the whole thing, but
no, I couldn't even start it. I'm too much of like an empath. I'm like,
I got through some of it, but it reminded me like, oh, when you're alienated from yourself, you don't have access to your authentic voice or your wants, your needs. And then how can you be in a community? So I think in some ways, you know, being in this pandemic is it's an odd opportunity to really listen more closely to ourselves and like ask, who am I and how do I feel and what do I want and what do I need? So I've really been thinking about voice in that context. But of course, you know, everybody else comes along too. That's Linda. Linda never comes out. You know why? Because my nails are not done. Mm. And Linda is like an old school, you know, New York City, like the thing with the nails. She was like that, the manicure. And now it's like, oh my God, my nails are naked. Like she would be the person to be like, oh my God, don't look at my hands.
Where did you find Linda?
Long Island. I was, I mentioned my mom's a doctor. She had a private practice on Long Island's with a Z at the end.
Long Island's? There's more than one.
No, just Long Island's, but you got to hit the sibilant SZ end.
Yeah.
So Long Island's, you know what I mean? You could be from Staten Island's, but there's like a little Z at the end of it. Mm-hmm. Not plural, just a little.
Yeah. Yes.
A little zhuzh on it.
The D and the T can both handle this. And it's also a New Jersey thing, like tonight, with like this little T that happens at the end.
Tonight.
It's gorgeous.
And what are we doing tonight?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, Linza. So there's even a little Z in there, Linza. Oh my God, Linza. You know? Mm-hmm. She represented the sort of second, third generation, you know, European immigrant wave that then everybody went into, you know, my brother's a cop, my sister's a nurse, my husband's an electrician, like that, you know, sort of like this solid working class, into middle class, white Long Island. And that's part of my family. Oh my God. So anyway, and then if you like went to nicer schools or whatever, it started to come out of you. And then you went to NYU and you completely got rid of it because it's embarrassing. You know, there was a lot of associations of class with accent, but that's where Linda came from. She was a tech in my mom's office.
There was this amazing New York Times article about you from a while ago that sort of followed you as you approached people on the street.
Oh my God.
I guess part of what I'm interested in is like, what is it to approach strangers? Like, what is that muscle?
Yeah.
In a way that isn't disrespectful and that isn't treating them like a subject of a specimen.
Well, and I think I occupy an interesting space, right? Because I'm a woman of mixed heritage, black from a distance, as we say. And on the kind of racial hierarchy and the gender hierarchy, it's very different for me to approach a cis white male, you know, straight dude, and kind of
learn how he talks and like spend time with them and like whatever.
Yeah, we'll leave Andrew out of this for now. But going up to people on the street, I think that, like I said, I feel a certain responsibility to remember that, especially as a traditionally marginalized person myself, my voice was usually, you know, belittled, mocked. And so I always feel like I remember, you know, listening to a woman on the bus who had like, you know, you can hear this Russian, Ukraine, you can hear her voice when she's talking, what is accent, and how does it feel to imagine, what is her life? Not only, oh, this is SNL, I'm going to make funny voice to make fun some lady who maybe have been through hell, maybe have survived unbelievable things, maybe is genius in her home country. But here she comes, she doesn't have what she's needing. How do you make sure you honor this person? You give to them what they deserve, like human beings. So that's my, I always really try to imagine the internal life of the person. And then, I'm not going to get it spot on every time, but I have been observing a lot of people for a long time. I lived in New York. I lived in Queens, the most diverse borough in the world. And I had access to a lot of different people because of my family, and I went to the UN school. So I started to get a sense of like, this is a person I can approach. This is a person I should leave alone who's having a moment, and it's none of my business to sneak up on them. Right. I always, when you see a photographer, and I hate to say it, but like, you know, a nice white hipster getting in the face of like some brown person in Williamsburg. Like when I left New York, that's what was going on. Like, I'm going to take pictures and be gritty. And it's like, no, dude, that's actually your white privilege, you know, and your lack of understanding that that person doesn't belong to you, even if your intentions are good. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that, right? Like ownership of narratives. And I think it's subversive for a black woman to write for a wealthy white frat dude. And that is why I enjoy doing it.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah. And you use, do you use voice memos and actually record them, or is it
I mean, voice memos are basically how I get by. So when I heard that I would need to have some voice memo work to join you here today, I was like, oh, my people.
It's home.
Yeah. It's home. I have so many. And I try out new, I have started to work on it a little bit. It's very new and not at all where I would like it to be. But I started to think about in Nigeria, or what would it be if I wanted to just work on that and work on that a little bit during this pandemic. So it's starting to be fun. I'm starting to have a good time with it. But you know, I like voice memos give me that pure opportunity to feel into something and then try it out and let it be hairy and ugly and have warts and not be where I'd like it to be yet. Or I could just share that with your entire audience.
On the theme of letting perfection go.
Exactly.
And also honestly letting us into the process, because that's, you know, it's not like you're a magician and if you give away the trick, there is no trick anymore. It's still magical at the end, don't worry.
Well, that's funny that you say that, but that was a huge fear of mine. I would never, I mean, until I, so my gran, my mom's mom, was Irish-American, German-American. But I went to Ireland. I spent a lot of time there. I spoke to loads of different people. There's so many different accents. And I thought, I've got to have a perfect... It can't be like, you can't think, oh, you know, did you start off in kind of County Cork and then migrate down to Dublin? But you can't tell what... I was so obsessive. What schools would she have gone to? And what was the slang of the time? And it was just... It spilled over out of the respect for the character and into perfectionism, which is a subtle form of self-abuse, really, and abuse of the art. So I'm mindful of that now, that I don't have to present a perfect... I can't. There's no such thing as perfection. I will never be perfect. I will have critics. That was such a fear, was like, what I do is so important to me and I believe in it so much that I want it to be perfect, but then it spilled over into kind of... You know, what do they say? The three P's, perfectionism, procrastination, and paralysis. That's what started to happen to me as a creative person until I got some help around it.
That's really real. That's really real.
It's real.
I'm starting a new project right now, and I could stand to be reminded that those three P's are not a path that is going to serve me.
No, but you're forgiven for, you know, I mean, we're all human and we're raised in a culture. I mean, especially in cancel culture, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if
there is a great extent to which there is a reason for me wanting to, I want to be excellent. I want to bring the truth and the love of this person, for example, a lady who is based very loosely on the a Palestinian woman that I met, who is a Jordanian, and wanting to, again, what is her story? Not to judge, not to decide before, that if I get caught in my own head, then it is not about her anyway. It is about me and what do you think of Sarah Jones, not what do you think of Hella, what do you think of this, you know, person.
So I think, like, in a way, whatever you're working on, if you remind yourself that you are its, I don't want to say servant, but that's, I do. I think of myself as a public servant, or I work in service of whatever it is that I think is important enough that I need to put it out into the world. And then I'm not allowed to say, oh, but I'm not perfect enough. I have to just suck it up and be a worker and, you know, do what the project asks you to do. So I'm excited for whatever you're working on. Let it dictate. You don't have to do anything except show up and be you.
Yeah, that's beautiful and really hard to do. Thank you, Sarah. We'll be back in a moment.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
And we're back with Sarah Jones. Okay, so when your characters are on stage aware of the audience,
yeah,
something happens to them. It's not just them in their natural state. It's them finding themselves in a public arena. And it feels like it's a metaphor for all of us. How do you think about that side of it?
You know, it's really, it depends on the stage. It depends on the context. And I find that they each have their own reaction and their own internal conflict, which can frustrate me, by the way. I want them to articulate and project. If I'm, you know, at an outdoor venue in India with 5,000 people, that's not the best time for, you know, I don't know, Rashid to suddenly start, yeah, you know what I'm saying? We in India and yo, this is crazy right now. I want him to sound better than that. But he's going to say and experience what he's experiencing. I remember, there was a character, Pauline Ling. Pauline is not her actual name, but that's the name that she wanted me to use for her. And she had to be on stage in front of people, and she was very aware of it. And it was always a meta thing, because there's the stage in the, you know, Broadway house, and then there's who she's really talking to, which is a small cafe audience in her mind. And she thought she is, there's people, she does not want people to misunderstand, to be a immigrant from China, but also to come through Hong Kong. This is a very difficult time in her life that she had to explain that to strange people. And this is so difficult. Like maybe you don't want to say it can be shameful to talk about yourself in front of people, but that's what she had to do for her daughter. The story in the play was that her daughter is coming out and at the time didn't have the right to get married to her partner, who was Chinese-born and needed the immigration status that she couldn't get at that time because of homophobia. Couldn't get married. And so for Mrs. Ling to have to come out as like a PFLAG parent, you know, and just to speak, that feeling of, I will just be honest, I know that she always felt like, these idiots. Like, I'm sorry, I just need to say, in her mind, I could feel her saying, I speak two languages. They don't know how hard it is for me to have to speak right now in front of them, knowing my English is imperfect, and that they might be so ignorant, they don't even realize I am actually the badass here.
Yep.
And I remember that feeling for her. I remember I would just get a little mix of anger would come in. But and I remember that feeling of, if your mission is vital enough to you, you will tolerate the discomfort of standing in front of a crowd and saying what you need to say. Speak even if your voice shakes. Speak even if you feel like your audience isn't the most friendly. I remember that. That's what comes up for me with the characters. Each of them has their own experience of reluctance, but there's a motivation that's stronger than their fear of being perceived as less intelligent because they're an immigrant and they speak halting, you know, English as a second language.
That's the thing. That's the thing. And that's the thing for everybody. I mean, for everybody who's listening and for all of us, you know, obviously there is fear that comes from public speaking because we're being seen. And yet, if our need is bigger than our fear, and so how do we invest in what that need is? If we have to public speak for our job, for our livelihood, for our whatever, how do we find the way to make it something we want to do or we need to do so hard that we overcome the fear side of it?
You know what helps me? Remembering back to childhood, who I was as a child before all of the kind of messaging about you know, image management, how you have to sound. I mean, I had so many messages. I had relatives who sound like that. And I was like, oh, I'm supposed to sound like that too. I had to be from the West Indies and I have to be like this to be cool. And then I got to Washington, D.C. My parents moved around because they were students, medical students and all of that when I was really little. And so I remember arriving at the black school and everything I thought was cool was terrible. You know, I was like, they were like, you sound like a white girl. You know, don't know. I had just so many different ways of talking to all my different relatives. And I had to learn I had to learn something else. Sarah Jones, you know, I had to learn how to say my name just a different way. And I had to learn how to fake, you know, people would be like, yeah, I was in church. I'd be like, yeah, me too. You know, it was like, I wanted to fit in.
Well, this is the coping mechanism.
This is the coping mechanism.
I don't know. I may have an ADHD diagnosis. I haven't found out yet.
I think that might be part of your genius. So I don't know if I'd want you to medicate it.
I haven't ever done the meds, which is so, I mean, I think my characters are my meds, which is not to say that I don't need additional meds.
But this reminds me, I have a quote I want to read of yours. You said, I have to get sleep. I have to sleep for 20 people. I feel responsible for these people. So I have to treat them well and exercise well. I meditate and go to therapy twice a week if I can, because it's a lot. And this is the part I want to highlight, to feel. I'm feeling people's experiences every time I do the show. And surely more than just every time you do the show.
I remember when the stages started getting bigger. Like Broadway is, you know, it's still 600 people a night and you do it every night. And it's a very specific discipline. I was like a monk, you know, it really was like this, you know, committed relationship that I had with these characters. It was like, all right,
what is it? I don't know. Do you solemnly, whatever, I can't remember my wedding vows. Yeah, do you solemnly swear? Do you, Sarah, take these characters to be your, you know, do you characters take Sarah to be your emissary, to be your vessel until, you know, ticket sales do us part or whatever? And it just ran and ran. And I remember the feeling of, if I don't remember to tap into the resource of the characters, they are pure love. They're messy. They're imperfect. I have a white supremacist who won't admit he's a white supremacist. He's,
I'm a European American rights advocate. And that should not make anyone laugh or raise an eyebrow any more than all of the rest of you women and whatever the other, you know, black, or I don't know if you can say black anymore, whatever you're supposed to say about them, they can have their advocate groups and we can't. And I don't see, you know, Sarah Jones can make fun of me all the time and call me all kind of names, but I know that I want to be able to be proud to be European.
So I'd have to carry that dude around with me. And I take very seriously his Drudge Report reading, you know, Fox News believing version of America, because it's the only one he has. He is doing his best with what he has. He is, you know, behaving as I would if I were born into his body, into, you know, the bassinet in his house. And then remember that there's beauty. He has beauty. Like I have been moved to tears by the moments of his courage in admitting how much of a failure he feels himself to be, because his son is not making more money than he did in every generation. I mean, like I've done interviews where somebody interviews him or he's interviewing somebody, and the improv that comes out is like, oh, this is the pain of the white American male, you know, in middle America, that I am not going to privilege over the pain of people of color and, you know, working class people and immigrants who have suffered long and hard under racism and all the rest of it.
But he gets a place.
But he gets a place. He gets a place. And that is work for me.
Yes.
I don't love having to engage that conversation. And yet, I think that that all of the characters fortify me if I let them. And I have to do the work to make sure I'm available to receive the gift of like communing with other people within my own body and my own voice.
Well, and this feels like it taps into your, you know, we were talking about the character's urge to speak is greater than their fear, but also yours.
Yes, greater, but not without a mess sometimes. And I think the willingness to play in the spaces where it is not neat and tidy, I haven't figured it out. I am not cancel culture proof.
Yeah, tell me about that. What responses have you gotten that have really challenged you?
You know what's interesting? I remember performing for TED Talks. I think it's important to say that the bigger the platform, the bigger the sense of responsibility, and whoever that audience is, I notice I would do some self-policing around who I brought out and when. Mm. And, you know, that I had to really look at, like making a choice. I remember getting to perform at the White House. It was such it was so otherworldly to like have these black people in the White House. This was like 2009, the first time I went, I got to perform there.
Bring us back. Anything you want to tell us about that? We just want to live there for a sec.
I know, right? Can we just go back to 2014? I guess that was the last performance I did there, or 20, something like that. That feeling of a democratized White House, I didn't know how to bring.
I have a lady, I had somebody named Miss Lady. She live on the street, and she have, you know, what happened in this country when you are female and you black and you poor and you don't have no access to the same education opportunity or job opportunity or whatever, like some other people got. Some people don't want to hear you speak and talk. They don't want to hear you. They think you sound ignorant or whatever.
But I want to tell them I don't need fancy words to be an important person. But Sarah Jones didn't want to bring me up in the White House because she wanted to be dignified with Obama. I am dignified. I may don't have no place where I can lay my head at night, but that don't mean I'm not no dignified person. You understand?
So I noticed my own fear would sometimes mirror, or not mirror, I guess what I'll say is I remember performing a whole slew of characters, different races, different ethnicities, different genders. This was at a medical, I was like at a medical school or something. I did a show about health and ethnic and racial health disparities back when people were saying they didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I came across that in your research and was like, well, hello, coronavirus.
Hello, coronavirus. So anyway, back then I was doing this piece and I still do it from time to time because medicine is racist. I grew up in medicine and my father being assumed to be an orderly because he's a black man, even though he was the doctor and the head of the department. So this moment of performing in front of a mixed race audience where there had been some conflict and they had sort of invited me. I felt like a diplomat or something coming to try to be like, okay, everybody. But this one white woman stood up and said, and her voice was shaking, and I had created a safe space and I'm very proud of myself for that. I said, I let everybody know, look, this is racist, messy, tricky stuff. And she said, well, all of them were good people except for the one who looked like me. And I was like, wow. I couldn't even unpack. And I said, well, wait a minute. Which one looked like you? Because I've looked like this the whole time. I never changed color. And I felt her experiencing the reality that her mind told her I was white. Her mind told her I was white when I was doing the character that offended her.
Yeah.
And she said, the white one. And I said, well, I did a few white characters. And she didn't identify Lorraine, who's Jewish, as white. Like, it was such a telling moment, right? Who this woman latched onto as the mirror of herself. And all the white nurse said was, I don't see color. And, you know, why do I have to be culturally competent? Why don't they learn to speak English? Which is something that a lot of people say and believe, including in the medical field. So it was fascinating to watch this woman suffer. She was in so much pain, confronted with racism and confronted with, you know, white supremacy and her, you know, possible complicity in it.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that because that was painful. I like to have a good time. I like to get a standing O where everybody's laughing and rolling in the aisles and having a wonderful experience with me and goes home feeling warm and fuzzy about me. And I don't think that woman felt super warm and fuzzy in that moment, but it was a teachable moment for everybody in that room.
Well, and also this is a bigger question, but what is your goal?
Yeah. I mean, I just told you what I like. You know, I like to feel delicious and for millions of people to watch my TED Talks and tell me how much they love me. What I don't shy away from and what I know is more important is that people have an experience that holds a mirror up to them.
In which case, boy, did you fulfill your goal.
I did. And I didn't go home. You know, that wasn't a day when I got to feel like I, you know, created a rollicking good time for everyone in the audience. It was more like, and in fact, I remember there was a meet and greet afterward and doctors, you know, white, very straight laced.
Very straight.
Yeah. I was trying to soften that a little bit.
I liked it.
Very, very straight. Like super white, that dude, you know, that guy from like wherever we were, Michigan.
Oh, I know. I say this too, like a super straight white guy. Like, I don't know what I don't know what the gradations are there, but there you go.
Right. This is the superest and the straightest. Okay. And the guy-est. And these are the men who, are, you know, at kind of the center of, white supremacist capitalist patriarchy in our country. They are part of what I think of as the medical industrial complex that is profit driven and creates terrible problems for doctors, including right now in COVID, they're slashing doctors' salaries. And I know it's like, oh, boo-hoo, doctors. Listen, I watched my parents. I saw what the insurance companies, the lobbyists, all of that, what it, you know, does to our health as a society, including destroying the lives of the medical professionals we need. But I digress. These men, these white men, came up to me, I swear to you, a couple of them had tears in their eyes saying, I don't know how to talk about this stuff. I don't know how to talk about it with my staff. You seem nice, but I don't, you know, I have black friends or I don't have black. Like, I felt like Oprah. I felt like a fucking therapist or something who was like the maybe the one time anybody had ever said, hey, white man, you know, maybe you're going to wait until after the Q&A because you don't want to publicly say this. But people who, after a couple of cocktails, were able to come up to me and say, effectively, this feels messy. This feels problematic. I don't want to feel like I'm complicit in any of it. But you touched something.
Yeah.
That's my work. That's my job. Yes. And it's not the rah-rah. It's not, it doesn't get me a million followers on the gram. It's very different work.
Well, and also it's funny because it actually ties into our sort of like offhanded conversation at the top about expectations, because you're like your whole job is making people question what their expectations are for you and also for every character you bring up there and then also for themselves.
Yeah. I didn't pick the easiest job. Apparently, I should have picked president of the United States because you only got to do shit.
I mean, any day now, I'm happy to vote for you. I'm happy to vote for you. yeah. Well, and also, I wonder if it sounds sort of like it picked you.
It did choose me. And I do have a kind of cultural ADHD, probably, in the sense that I want to talk about immigrants and the prison industrial complex and, you know, discrimination in healthcare and our education system and capitalism and where we are as a society economically. I want to talk about all of those things at the same time.
Also, you know, I don't want for my audience you to leave out sell-by date.
Right. And the shirt I'm wearing, which says eroticize equality, is a, you know, it's a reference to actually it's a Gloria Steinem mm-hmm. quote. And it's a reference to where we are with feminism and power and sex and how we self-identify and self-invent as women. And I still know that when I walk into a room filled with the white guys who still, by and large, run Hollywood and decide whether I get movie roles or TV roles or, you know, a show on the air, I promise you, every single project I have ever done, a white man is right there deciding whether it gets funded or not, period. A white straight man. And to be clear about that, that even with movements, you know, some subtle movement, I can count on my fingers and toes the women, the people of color who have, you know, the kind of power to begin to shift all of this stuff. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we're like, oh, you know, we have a hashtag now, so it's changed or it's really changing in a big, meaningful way. No, it isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't yet. And I think like getting clear that there's a reason we're intersectional, right? I need to bring all of that stuff into the conversation because there is no talking about women without talking about the environment and climate change. There is no talking about poverty without talking about trafficking and human beings and why their bodies are sold. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I mean, when you were listing the sort of themes you've always been interested in, I just was thinking the entire time, like, it's just justice. It's just justice. It's just justice.
It's just justice.
And
it's
like,
just social
you know,
justice.
When I started taking my kid to marches, which was like, you know, sadly early in his life.
I was going to say like in the womb, right?
We are not sadly, but sadly that they're needed,
right.
But you know, obviously.
That we need him, right.
But when he was old enough to sort of slightly start to ask questions, I just, no matter what we were there for specifically, I mean, the first one where I remember he was actually conscious was the March for Our Lives, and I was not going to tell him that it was about, you know, gun violence against children. And so I said, we're marching for fairness. And every
yes.
single one of them were marching for fairness.
For fairness. Really, honestly, like, it helps me a lot to think of this in terms of humanity. Like when people, oh, are you a, and I'll say social justice, and I'll say I'm an activist, and I'll say I'm a progressive to radical. I'm a fucking human being.
Yes. Yes. Okay, we'll be right back after this, and we will find out who you brought in for us to listen to.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect.
Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
We're about to be back for Act 3. Just a note, Sarah's audio did not work for the final act, but we've got her Zoom backup sound. So, you don't want to listen because you are an audio purist. Bye. But otherwise, I think this actually worked out okay. The technology supported us, saved us. And I loved this act, so I didn't want to cut it. Here you guys go. We're back and we're going to find out who you brought in for us. Would you first just tell us?
So I'm very excited about this. Sonia Renee Taylor is a woman I've actually never met in person. But she has that kind of reach kind of into your soul. And I think maybe ironically is not the word, but ironically, it's through the body. She has a book, The Body Is Not an Apology, that makes an incredibly nuanced and loving argument that when we, as I think so many of us do in our culture, make our bodies, you know, kind of the site of where we fight our battle and, you know, how do I look and controlling our bodies and wanting to occupy a certain space in the culture, we actually cut off our soul.
So genius. Yeah. I'm going to link to her book as well. And I also just want to say, as somebody who's like on the voice soapbox, that, you know, voice doesn't exist except with our bodies. And whenever somebody has something that's going on with their voice that makes them feel like they're not being heard or that it's not coming out or that they're not revealing their true selves when they want to be, it has to do with their bodies.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay, here she is.
Every time you call truce with your body, you interrupt a system of violence and power that profits off of your self-hate. Every time you interrogate the beliefs and biases that you have about other bodies, you interrupt a system that profits off of the way that you feel about other bodies and the systems of comparison that we live in. Our relationship with our bodies is our access to a more just and equitable world. Our relationship with other people's bodies is how we bend the box towards justice.
When I watched her TED Talk, which that's from, I was struck by, I mean, of course, part of the job of being somebody whose whole, you know, being is to say that the body isn't an apology is how do you show up on stage? You know, how do you show up with your body? And one of the answers is that I haven't seen an actor doing Shakespeare in a while. And that's, you know, like that's what she's doing. And there's a later part in that same talk where she switches into a poetry mode where she's actually, I don't know what the verb is. I was going to say reciting, and that's so wrong.
Embodying.
Yeah. Doing poetry. But you can even hear it in that clip that there's a way that she uses her body in connection with her voice that just feels like she's under herself. Mm-hmm. She's not beside herself. She's not next to you. She's not running after. She's in it.
She embodies the poem. Right? She is the embodiment of the poem, or she, it's almost like she offers her body in service of the poem community.
It's sort of, yeah, it's a bit of the vessel imagery or emissary. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not the same style as a conversational style. And, you know, I listened to some clips of her in conversation too, and it's kind of cool to just see, you know, obviously she's a great reminder that all of us have different modes.
Yes.
You know, and I'm not saying that that one mode is one that, you know, any of us should sort of steal period or steal for the wrong mode or take the wrong lessons from, but to see somebody knowing that what they're talking about is big and that they're taking the breath to support that big of a thought and thus teaching us that that thought is as big as it is, is a real lesson. So thank you for bringing her in. Thank you for talking to me, Sarah, and all of the people that you brought with you. You are a wonder.
Thank you so much for letting me just meander all over the place. It's beautiful to be here.
Yay. Thank you. Thank you to Sarah Jones for joining me. You can find out more about her in the show notes or on our website, permissiontospeakpod.com. There's also a super cool bit of bonus content this week on our Instagram feed at Permission to Speak Pod, where Sarah talks about the secret of playing cool when you meet your heroes. It's really, really special and real. Please also send me DMs or voice memos to at Permission to Speak Pod on Instagram or the website, and let me know what is going on with your voice. I would be thrilled to answer it in the next mailbag episode. Also, tell me what kind of guests you'd like me to have on, and also what kind of questions you would like me to ask upcoming guests. I'm so truly here for you. I especially feel like during these wild and rather unsettling times, if we can think really intentionally about how our communication allows us to be more vulnerable and more heart forward with the people in our lives, that is something we should be doing. And even more than any of that, I would so love for you to just tell me what you need from me. If I can provide it, I will. Thank you as well to Sophie Lichterman and the team at iHeartRadio, my family and cohort, and all of you. We're recording this podcast at various locations around Los Angeles on land that is the historic gathering place for the Tongva Indigenous tribe. And you can visit usdac.us to learn more about honoring Native land. Permission to Speak is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Vision, executive produced by Catherine Burke Canton and Mark Canton. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.